Is everybody well settled? Perhaps you tell me at any point if you can't hear what I'm saying, but with this mic it should be all right, even at the back there. Well, can I welcome everyone here? Thank you all for coming. Hope to see you at subsequent lectures as well. What I'll be talking about in these lectures, of which there'll be eight, there'll be eight lectures following in sequence four this term, weekly on Wednesdays, and then for next term, also on Wednesdays, eight lectures in total. The theme of these lectures is modernity and its impact on the world. Modernity sounds like a difficult notion, but what modernity means is essentially modern industrial civilization. That kind of civilization in which certainly we in the West live, but which has now increasingly become global. Of course, one of the questions we have to ask in these lectures is modernity a Western project? In what sense are we living under the shadow of the Westernization of the world? Whatever one makes of the impact of that question, that we are living in a period of fundamental transformation is impossible, I think, to doubt. Now, just to begin with, everyone here, I hope, has got a copy of this book list. Is anyone who hasn't got a copy of it? Are there any more up the top there anywhere? I'll try and get these ones. Oh, there, is that a surplus one? Anyone's got a surplus one, perhaps pass them back. Up there. Maybe everyone at least could get a look at one, and then anyone who hasn't got one, there are some on this platform here that you could pick up afterwards. If everyone could get a look at them, I'd just like to whiz quickly through the book list, tell you a bit about the books on the list, and that'll also allow me to show what the structure of the lectures I'm proposing is. So I hope everyone's got at least a look at this book list. It goes on the back, so it's a bit longer than it looks if you just look at the front of it. Going down the book list, if you draw a line under Dickens, which is about the seventh one down, the top group of books are all about what you might call, as one of these authors does, global shift, the impact of globalization on contemporary world society. I shan't be talking about globalization today. I'll be talking about the backdrop to the expansion of a world society. But the next lecture, the theme of globalization will be my primary concentration. Globalization now means really the spread of modernity across the world. So if you talk about modernity today, you are talking about an increasingly globalizing civilization. Just quickly, these books here, the first book, Global Dreams, is a good accessible discussion of some of the main parameters of globalization in contemporary world culture. It's quite well written. It's easy to follow. It distinguishes four or five main contexts in which globalization is occurring. Underneath this, Featherstone Global Culture, has more of a discussion of, as the title suggests, cultural globalization carried by electronic media, the impact of that, the clash between different cultures, and as we'll discuss later in this course, possibly the clash of civilizations. It's, again, quite an accessible book. My book, The Consequence of Modernity, gives you some indication of my thinking anyway on these issues, and I'll be plundering this book a bit in these lectures. Martin Allbrow's book, The Global Age, is I think one of the best recent discussions of globalization. What Allbrow argues is that we're not in a postmodern era, we are in an era of the globalization of modernity. This era, however, has very different characteristics from the early period of the evolution of Western industrial culture. John Gray, I don't know if you know John Gray's writings. John Gray is a famous political philosopher at Oxford, but I'm pleased to say he will be joining the LSE on the 1st of January, 1998. And this book, False Dawn, hasn't yet dawned. In other words, it won't be published until February 1998, but I'll still be lecturing then. He'll also be lecturing here by then, so it'll be a happy conjunction of circumstances. This book is about the impact of globalization, especially the impact of global financial markets, False Dawn. And you can tell by the title what his attitude to expansion of globalization is, I think. The next book down, Hurst and Thompson, is the main book by the so-called globalization skeptics. That is, people who believe that claims about the impact of globalization today are essentially false, and that the world of the late 20th century does not look any different from the world of the late 19th century. That's Hurst and Thompson's main argument. There hasn't really been a fundamental shift in the extent and level of globalization. Therefore, those who say that they have are simply basing their claims on false empirical data. We'll look at this claim in the next lecture next week. But if you're interested in the issue of globalization, and I think in a certain sense, this is the debate of the moment, this is the debate of the social sciences of the turn of the 21st century, this is certainly an essential source for a skeptical look at what's going on in the world. Finally, Peter Dickin, Global Shift, is a very good discussion of the expansion of the global division of labor, the relocation of industry worldwide, the shifting relationship between East and West, and the impact of the power and transformations of the large corporations in the global economy. You do need to get, as I put here, the new edition, which I think is 1996 edition, because that has pretty up-to-date data in it. If you go down this famous book list and you draw a line under three books down, Kallinikos, maybe I should have put a few more on, but the next three books are all about revolution in Eastern Europe. The topic I'll move on to after introducing the theme of globalization is the collapse of the Soviet Union, the reasons for it and Eastern European communism, the reasons for it and the prospects after 1989. Down here there are three useful sources. Ralph Dahrendorf, you probably know, is a previous director of the London School of Economics, very famous sociologist. His book is probably the best book, really, that's been written about the 1989 revolutions. It's quite short, it's quite accessible, very pithy, with a TH, very pithy book. One of the things about the 1989 revolutions is, you know, a true irony of history that we have to discuss in these lectures. Marx thought he was initiating a period of revolution which would transcend capitalism. We should also transcend liberal or parliamentary democracy, but the 1989 revolutions in Eastern Europe were a reversal of Marxist revolution back to industrial capitalism and liberal democracy. What was going on in history here? Fundamental question for our time. What interpretation one has of these revolutions and what they mean? The next book, Timothy Garton Ash, is primarily a journalist, but he does work at St. Anthony's College in Oxford, where Ralph Dahrendorf moved on to after the LSE. This is a very, very accessible account of which plots the sequence of change, really, in Eastern Europe. Fascinating thing about the East European revolutions, as I'm sure most people here will be well aware, is that they were relatively bloodless. Not much blood was shed in a period of very, very dramatic revolutionary transformation. Quite different from the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, Chinese Revolution, involved warfare, involved military power. Some people have seen the 1989 revolutions as the first revolutions of the globalized electronic culture because of the influence of television and electronic communication in them. And there was something new about these revolutions. I think it's therefore wrong to say they were just a reversion to the 19th century. There's something quite distinct about this change which we have to look at. Alex Kallinikos is a well-known left-wing writer who has his own view on the progression both of Western industrial capitalism and of the Soviet Union. Essentially, he is a follower of something like a Trotskyite view. Trotsky, you know, was always critical of the Soviet Union. Trotsky broke from Lenin and Stalin. Trotsky became the most celebrated critic excuse me, of the bureaucratic nature, the despotic nature of East European socialism or communism. Klinikos follows this line of thought. For him, the Soviet Union was never a socialist society. It was a deformed bureaucratic despotism. And for him, the ideas promised by Marx are still capable of realization, but this would have to be on a global scale, much as Trotsky always argued. I mean, I think contrary to what many people say and think now, Marxism is not dead. I mean, the critique that Marx offered of Western industrial capitalism still has a great deal of force. I don't know if anyone here deigns to dabble in reading magazines, but in the New Yorker magazine, last issue but one, if you want to check it, it was called Next, that issue. It's about what's coming next in world society. Very interesting article on Marx and the continuing relevance of Marx to the critique of capitalism. Unfortunately, where Marx went wrong was with socialism. But as a critic of capitalism, he was pretty peerless. And many of the things that Marx diagnosed about a capitalist society still seem to be there. The question is, what can we do about them in the absence of the solutions that Marx proposed? Next, if you go down over the page to the book by Kenichi Ohmae, O-H-M-A-E, Japanese writer, all the books in that block going down from Anderson to Ohmae are all books concerned with the next theme I'll take up, the role of nationalism and the transformation of the nation state. Nationalism is one of the guiding threads of 20th century history, still is very strong, declining in some respects, growing in others. Whatever you make of nationalism, the nation state is undoubtedly changing massively. Here in the UK, we see a double process, devolution of power to Scotland and Wales, hopefully the transformation of Northern Ireland, but going along with these, the upward devolution of power, if you can call it that, to the European Union and to a more globalizing set of institutions. These are among the biggest changes of our time. They are, again, aspects of incipient globalization, the emergence of something like a global cosmopolitan society, which we are the first generation, I think, to pioneer, essentially. Very quickly, some good books here. Benedict Anderson, Imagine Communities. I'd recommend is still probably the best book on nationalism. He argues that nationalism is based upon the invention of history. Especially it's based upon the invention of tradition. Many of the things that we assume to be long enduring about the idea of Britain, for example, or indeed about the idea of England or Scotland, were founded relatively recently, were creations of the 19th century, and were a way of creating a symbolic community. It was imagined because it doesn't correspond to real history, is the theme of the book. Nationalism is an imagined community. Ernest Gellner, one of the most famous professors ever to teach at the LSE, unfortunately died a few years ago, but his works represent the leading theorization of nationalism, I think, that anyone has produced. Nations and Nationalism, very accessible, short book, gives a good idea of Gellner's view. Gellner's view, to sketch it in briefly, was that nationalism goes along with modernity. Nationalism did not always exist. Nationalism is a product of the rise of Western industrial civilization, but has now again become global, of course, in its impact. Anthony Smith, next down, also famous writer on the theme of nationalism, currently, of course, also a professor at the London School of Economics. This is purely accidental. So many people down here, it's just in this little bit, I think. That's also a joke, so you could laugh a bit at it. A slightly parochial book list, really. Anthony Smith, though, is one of the great authorities on nationalism, and this is a very accessible book by him, one at the bottom of the page. If you turn the page, my book at the top here, also at the LSE, of course. Don't know how long I'll stay, but sort of passing through anyway. It's not so much about nationalism as about the nation state. I do think, I suppose, a lot of the most important debates are about the nation state rather than just nationalism as such. Montserrat Guibono, next one. You could treat as a substitute for Gellner and Smith, really. It's a good introduction to the general debates about nationalism. Very accessible, short, easy to read. Finally, Kenichi Omai is a well-known writer who argues that the nation-state is finished, that the nation-state, as he puts it, is just a fiction for us today. We live, he argues, in a borderless world. He wrote a book called Borderless World or Borderless Economy. The impact of globalization simply means that nation-state has become irrelevant to our current preoccupations. Omai is one of those authors who argues that in about a short period, maybe 20 or 30 years, there will be 1,000 city-states in the world. Nation-states will more or less, if not disintegrate, disaggregate. Singapore, Hong Kong, Barcelona, London are models of a global city. They live within their own hinterland and they are related to the global marketplace. They have no necessary connection to the larger state which they used to belong to, or so Omai says. That's a provocative version of the end of nation state thesis. One of the things you might be aware of and might like to think about through these lectures is the prevalence of endings in the social science literature and in the culture of the late 20th century. Almost anything you can think of, whether it's the family, whether it's work, whether it's science, whether it's history, someone has said the end of it. The end of socialism, the end of Marxism, the end of history, Francis Fukuyama, the end of science, the end of the family, the end of work, the end of the welfare state. Why? What is going on here? Are there just endings with no beginnings? Is this just a reflection of living in the shadow of the millennium? If I get time, it is one of the issues I quite like to discuss, but it's certainly a threaded issue through these lectures, really. What is going on here? It's a crisis, really, in Western intellectual culture, I think. Next group of books, down to Bill McKibben, are all essentially about ecological debates, except I choose to approach the issue of ecological crisis through the theme of risk. I want to argue the notion of risk connects closely with the larger crisis of Western intellectual thought that I just referred to. The idea of risk has become a central one to us, I think. Whether it's positive risk in the context of financial markets, which are driving the world economy, or whether, as it were, it's negative risk in the sense of ecological risks or other kinds of possible disasters, such as those associated with BSE, possible consequences of genetic engineering, and other scientific and technological changes which are being, in some sense, forced on us. At least I didn't vote for them, and I don't think no one here did, but they are happening. Very quickly, Ulrich Beck's book. I'm pleased to announce Ulrich Beck will also be coming to the LSE every year for 2 months. Well, I mean, we've got to get all these world stars in here. We've got to get this whole place energized. We've got to make it right on the cutting edge. That's the point of getting these great people here. Ulrich Beck is probably the leading German thinker, maybe leading continental social thinker of the moment. Risk Society got an enormous debate in Germany when it first came out 10 years ago. Its theme is that we're moving from an industrial society to a risk society, confronting risks which no one has ever had to confront before because of the march of human history. But it's not an easy book. It's not a beginner's book, I would warn you. So it's kind of a book to come on to when you've heard some of the lectures, hopefully, or when you've read some of the other literature. The theme of risk, however, is really, really interesting. At least I think it is, and I'll try and show why. The book by John Adams, Risk, is a very simple introduction to some of the risk literature. Much easier to read than Ulrich Beck, but not the same kind of path-breaking work as Ulrich Beck's book was and is. But nevertheless, very readable. Michael Mandel, High Risk Society, is an extension, if you like, of Beck's argument, even though he doesn't refer to Beck at all, but applied to the impact of financial markets on our lives. Mandel argues that the welfare state and other established institutions are, as it were, being attacked by global markets. To compete in global markets, you must be a risk-taking society, whether you're a worker or an entrepreneur. Global financial markets, he says, have a definite structure. That structure is one with lots of information, where everyone else also has lots of information, and where we're all trying to outguess everybody else. He says the whole of society is starting to look like that. This is the high-risk society. It's a really interesting book, I think, anyway. All these things relate to ecological debates, and I think they are the way in to what ecological debates actually mean. Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature, is a famous study in the ecological literature. The end of nature does not mean, of course, the end of the physical world. It means the transformation of the physical world by the impact of human science and technology. Nature is no longer natural. Nature is no longer nature in the sense of being influenced by human science and technology, which are everywhere. The next group of books down, from Max Weber through to John Donne, are all books on democracy. I'll be talking in this lecture about the global spread of democratization, what that means. Of course, this harks back to some degree to the 1989 revolutions in Eastern Europe, but is obviously a much wider issue than that. Why is democracy so important to us? No one liked democracy. Hardly anybody liked democracy until about the turn of the 20th century. Elites were against it. Women were excluded from it. Most men, in fact, were excluded from it. Most intellectuals were against it. What explains the global impact of democracy? Going through these books very quickly, Max Weber, Classical Thing, Classical Article on the Nature of Politics. Everybody who is at all interested in any aspect of politics should at some point read that. Not easy reading, though. David Held, very good discussion of different ideas about democracy, as is Robert Dahl, Democracy and Its Critics. Key book, I think, if you're interested in these debates, Francis Fukuyama, The End of History. He coined the phrase The End of History. This book is actually a very readable book. And it is a very provocative thesis. There is no more history to live. As I'll be saying in a few minutes, the Enlightenment invented history. Perhaps the end of history isn't the end of change, it's the end of a way of looking at our lives and understanding where we came from and where we're going to. A book I'd recommend is John Donne, Democracy, the Unfinished Journey. It's an edited book. It's a very, very good collection, actually, of the global position with democratization. It's a very comparative book, looks at countries around the world. Accelerating, so as not to use up the whole bloody lecture going through these things. The next group of books down to Jeffrey Weeks, Sexuality, are about the impact of modernity on our personal lives. Now, I think that, you know, contrary to what one might imagine, a lot of the most profound changes introduced by modernity and becoming globalized at the end of the century are changes in emotional life. There is a tremendous transformation of the emotions, of our relationship to our bodies and our relationship to our self-identities. Just as Freud wrote, you know, several decades ago, about the troubles of civilization, its discontents, you can produce a different version now, which, however, tries to do what Freud did, track modernity through the intimacies of life. And after all, these are the concepts of life in which many people, I think, as it were, live most profoundly in love relationships, in friendships, and in family connections. Enormous changes going on in these things worldwide. Zooming through this, Foucault, famous thing, the book on sexuality, difficult to read. Giddens, well, I don't know why I put too many of my books down here, it sounds terrible. So I'll pass over that one. Lauber, Paradoxes of Gender. Very good book on gender relations and changing relation between the sexes. Rubin, I particularly recommend if you're interested. I suppose no one here is interested in sex, but it's a very good discussion. This is an academic, intellectual place, isn't it? It's a very good discussion of the sexual revolution of the 60s and what it meant for changes in people's behavior. As you know, this is a massive political debate between the right and the left, what the sexual revolution meant. The sexual revolution is really a revolution in gender relationships, but it is profoundly a revolution in style of life, emotion and the self, I think, anyway. finally, Jeffrey Weeks' book, Sexuality, very accessible, very good summary version of lots of the literature, sociological literature on sexuality. Finally, last group of books are all about politics. In the last lecture, I'd like to trace out what the impact of all this is for the welfare state, for the parameters of modern politics. My book, Beyond Left and Right, is my attempt to do this. Will Hutton's book, The State We're In, became a bestseller. It is primarily about Britain, whereas we'll have a more global emphasis, however. Jeff Mulgan's book, Life After Politics, I'd recommend. Good little collection taken from publications of Demos, the think tank, which Mulgan heads. Mulgan is, however, also now one of the key figures in the policy unit in Downing Street, therefore having quite a lot of impact directly on British and European politics. Norberto Bobbio, the most celebrated Italian political thinker of the past generation. Now in his late 70s, I believe, or maybe even early 80s. This book, you can imagine like a book on gardening or cooking selling, you know, in Britain like this. This book sold 300,000 copies in Italy, Bobbio's book Left and Right, showing the still political culture in Italy. It's a really interesting little discussion of whether or not there still is a significant division between left and right with the collapse of communism and socialism. What does it all mean? None of us knows. Skidelsky, The World After Communism. Skidelsky is kind of rightish thinker, but actually it's a very good book, I think. Whatever political position one takes, very good discussion of the significance of the transformation of the Soviet Union. Just concluding these organizational things, can I give you my email address? Because what I'd like to do is just that anyone emails me who's got some questions they like to ask. Depending on how many replies I get, I can't necessarily guarantee to answer, but what I thought I'd do is try and answer one or two questions at the following lecture, which somebody might have thought of at the end of the preceding lecture. Because when I gave a series of lectures in the previous academic year, it was pretty impossible having a direct discussion with so many people present. It used up too much time. So I thought I'd have the system. My email address is A.Giddens, G-I-D-D-E-N-S, capital G, at LSE, little letters, dot AC, in little letters, dot UK. I should write it on that thing, but it's too frightening. It's A.Giddens at small LSE dot small AC dot small UK. Please feel free to communicate on this email site. Can I now move on to provide, as it were, a more solid grounding for the rest of these lectures, which, to repeat, are about the rise of Western industrial civilization, its globalization, and its current global impact. Now, if you look at the progression of human history, better try this horrible thing. You might think that human history goes like this, from the sort of early days of small societies up to modern industrial society. But human history doesn't look like that at all. The shape of what we've come to call human history does not look like that. Instead, it looks like this. Enormous period of probably 95,000 years or so with not very much change. World society dominated by hunting and gathering and small agricultural communities. Sometime, no one is completely clear when, you had the first rise of civilization. May have been something between about 5,000 to 7,000 years ago. The first civilizations mark a discontinuity in history. These are the civilizations, for example, of the early Middle East, or later on of traditional China or India, and later on still of Mesoamerica. These were urban-based civilizations, like the civilization of ancient Rome, perhaps the Rome and China being the two grandest traditional civilizations. Now, they injected dynamism into history. They invented armies. Some people think they even invented war. They invented cities, and to some extent, they invented science, too. history became more dynamic with the arrival of the large urban-based civilizations. You're still talking here of a period of maybe 5,000 years. When you had the impact of modernity or modern industrial capitalism, you have this, I've drawn this perhaps a bit too sort of steep, you have incredible acceleration of dynamism. Modernity is by far the most dynamic society in history. If you're talking about a period of radical transition here, and this is, you're only talking here of something from maybe the early part of the 18th century through to our time, that part of the 20th century, something like two centuries, you get the most fantastic transformations in world history. Modernity, therefore, in some sense, is easily the most dynamic civilization in history. It has no counterpart in previous civilizations. You should discard the idea of some kind of simple evolution in history. Instead, you're dealing with rupture. You're dealing with two major historical periods of transformation. The pace of change is much greater with the advent of modernity. That is the sheer speed of change. You're probably writing with pens which weren't invented 5 years ago. Everyone who's followed the lead time of information technology knows how rapid this is. The pace of change is much greater than ever before, especially of technological change, I think. The intensity of change is greater than ever before. That is, our lives are penetrated by change much more directly and completely than ever before. In the traditional civilizations, for example, most people still lived in agricultural communities where the pace of change was quite slow. It was much faster in cities, but in most of these societies, the pace of change was slow. Technological change took ages to reach down to the peasant community, if it ever did. For us, it's immediate. Consider, for example, innovations in medical technology. They come through immediately with all their consequences for us. Finally, the scope of change is much greater. Change with the advent of modernity itself becomes globalized. That is, change becomes, the transformative scope of change is vastly greater than any previous civilization, partly because modernity is globalizing. All the previous major civilizations were geographically limited. This is not true of modern industrial civilization, which spreads everywhere. Marx captured this very well. Marx argued, for reasons that not sure I ever will get to discuss in these lectures, but intrinsic to Marx's theory, Marx argued that modernity, modern industrial civilization, is a civilization which cannot stay still. It has no means of staying still. Previous civilizations, for the most part, always did stay still. There wasn't that much change in them. Modernity cannot. It is a restless civilization where constantly lifestyle habits are changed, which restlessly spreads across the world, devours other civilizations in its path, destroys them, and substitutes for them a universal industrial way of life. That was Marx's theory, really, of the global spread of industrial capitalism. Very, very interesting, I think, because how long can you live in a civilization which can't stay still? Very much related to the ecological problems we face. Could we get back to some more steady state civilization if indeed it were desirable? But this is not happening. I mean, at the end of the 20th century, it is much faster pace of change than ever before. I think it's accelerating, this process of being restless, of always on the lookout for something new. By the way, that's what modernity meant originally. Modernity means looking for something new. It means rejecting the past, looking for something new. And I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. Now, whoever says modernity says revolution. Modernity is a revolutionary civilization. And I'd propose to you that there are three major revolutions, certainly in the early phase of the development of modern Western society, which got it all going, and which are still the energizing dynamics of our society today. The three great revolutions. Make a change, put this in green. Three great revolutions were Industrial Revolution? Or to put it more accurately but more cumbersomely, Capitalist Industrial Revolution? Political Revolution, especially the rise of democracy? And Ideological Revolution? Ideological Revolution is linked with the dominant role of the Enlightenment in Western culture, and now the impact of the Enlightenment across the world, or the residue of the Enlightenment today. Which is to say something about these. We're talking here about roughly the middle to the late 18th century, when you get a series of parallel transformations in what was previously a very obscure part of the world, Western Europe. Western Europe was not a leading civilization until at least the 17th century. By the 18th century, especially the late 18th century, is the period of these three transformations. First, Industrial Revolution. Now, when you think of Industrial Revolution, you often think of the sort of pictures of Industrial Revolution that you get in school history books, which is children dragging carts through mines or spinning jennies and that kind of thing. But that is not really the way to think of it. Industrial Revolution meant a total change in the way of life of the people that it impacted on. The Industrial Revolution was a transformation of the way in which people lived, not just of the economy itself. It's quite easy to demonstrate this. If you compare, for example, the older forms of agrarian civilization with the society initiated by the Industrial Revolution, in terms of the proportion of people working in agriculture, and therefore living in rural areas, and the proportion of people working in manufacture, and therefore often living in cities, you see the most remarkable difference. If you look at the heyday of Rome, at its great point, its high point as a civilization, no more than 10% of the population, even at the peak of Roman civilization, lived in cities. 90% of the population lived and worked in rural areas, and those in the cities depended upon their agricultural production. You compare this with an industrialized society today, like this country, United Kingdom, or United States, or any other one, the most amazing transformation. No more than 2% of the population works in agriculture. It's an extraordinary thing. And this 2% of the population produces more food than we can actively consume in Western countries. It's one of the biggest transformations ever. The majority of the population is no longer agrarian with the expansion of the Industrial Revolution. This process began in the late 18th century, but it has culminated our time in the late 20th century, a more or less total transformation from an agrarian, agricultural-based society to an urban, manufacturing one, selling on markets. This is complete transformation in way of life. Second, another example, compare pre-modern civilizations with industrial civilization in respect to communications technologies. Communications technologies, especially with the new marriage between information technology and satellites, satellite connections, are transforming our lives in the late 20th century. The information revolution amounts to the fusion of these technologies. However, industrial society has long been different in respect of the industrialization of communications technology as compared to previous types of society. Very interesting to chart this out if you look at the history of Western society since the late 18th century. One of the main things that's made a difference, the first electronic transformation, the invention of Morse code in about the midpoint of the 19th century. Henry Morse invented the electronic or the electric telegraph. Morse code was the first means of communicating electronically. With the advent of Morse code, for the first time in human history, you could communicate with people who were geographically very distant from you. In all previous periods of history, you had to go somewhere to take a message. You had to have a fast horse or a ship or often messages would take ages. The invention of Morse code, and therefore the industrialization of communication through the joining of electricity to communication, created our world. You didn't have news before that. The idea of the news is an idea which substitutes for the past the immediacy of the present. The point about the news is that the news is lateral. It doesn't matter where it comes from, it's the fact that it happened very recently. Nothing is less interesting than yesterday's newspaper, but what a remarkable fact that is. The invention of the news is like a transformation again of the way in which we live. Really interesting to compare in previous ages how long it took to get to know what we would now call the news compared to what it takes now. A study was done of the impact of the death of George Washington. George Washington died in 1799 in Alexandria in Virginia. It took a week before that was in any newspaper in New York. It took a month before most of the population knew of this, and it took 3 months before most of the population of New Orleans knew of Washington's death. Compare that to the assassination of John F. Kennedy in the 60s. It's reckoned that half of the world's population knew of this event, within 24 hours of its occurrence. Compare this with the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, very recently. It's been calculated that almost the whole of the world's population knew of this event within something like 24 hours of its occurrence. A truly remarkable generalization of communication systems. This is a different world from any previous civilization. Second, political revolution. Political revolution means, above all, the rise of mass democracy, and this again is unique to modernity. By political revolution, one means above all, I think, the impact of the American Revolution, 1776, and the French Revolution of 1789, the two first genuinely mass revolutions of modern times. Now, historians often draw a distinction between rebellion and revolution. Rebellion has been very common in history, like peasant rebellions or religious rebellions. Peasant rebellions were mainly the risings of peasants against particular people. As in Shakespeare's plays, the peasants wanted to get rid of a monarch. They thought that all would be well if one could get rid of a tyrant. But they didn't seek to transform the overall political structure. The difference between a rebellion and a revolution is that a revolution is a secular attempt to transform the very structure of politics. Revolution is something new in history. The French Revolution is perhaps the prototypical revolution which sought to instill democratic rights for the population. Since the French Revolution, there have been a whole spate of revolutions across the world. The past century and a half has truly been a revolutionary century, beginning with the extension of bourgeois revolutions, or liberal democratic revolutions, leading to socialist revolutions like the 1917 revolution in Russia, or revolution in China, or in Cuba. This is an amazing expansion across the world of the impact of mass democracy. Mass democracy is very different, by the way, from classical democracy of Greece and Rome, which was always confined to a small aristocratic elite. Mass democracy, with the idea of political revolution, is something quite different. Finally, ideological revolution, really crucial, meant the impact of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment is a series of ideas produced by key thinkers of the late 18th century. These ideas have now become the stuff of our lives. It doesn't matter where you come, I think at the moment, from East Asia, or whether you come from the UK, the ideas pioneered by the Enlightenment have swept the world. They enter into conflict with traditional ideas, but they are fundamental to the expansion of modernity. What were these ideas? I would say there are three respects in which the Enlightenment thinkers sought to instill something new, very successfully, into Western culture. In all of these, they were influenced by science. The Enlightenment thinkers thought of science as the clue to how we should live in the world and how, as human beings, we should conquer the world. First, the Enlightenment thinkers sought to break with tradition, to break with the past. The point of the Enlightenment was to give us fresh knowledge about the future. The Enlightenment thinkers believe that tradition, dogma, religion stand in the way of a clear understanding of ourselves. To understand ourselves, we must break with the past, and we must attempt to organize the future. Ever since then, the West has seen the future as a kind of territory which can be occupied. Just as the West has marched into other territories, Western culture sees the future as an open territory, which if we can find about enough about the present, we can hope to enter and colonize. The colonization of the future is a key aspect of Enlightenment thought. This is something, therefore, about time. What the Enlightenment did was to invent history. History did not exist before the Enlightenment, where history means the idea that time has a direction. When we think of history now, we think of it traveling a straight line, a dating system from Rome back there all the way through to the year 2000. But no one thought of history like that previously. It's not obvious that history is the same as change. History could just be the continuity of things, and that's what it is in more traditional cultures. The invention of history is the invention of a way of looking at ourselves and looking at the future, which was something very new, but which has so infected our lives now that it's very hard to imagine what life was like without it. But it is an invention of the Enlightenment history in that sense. Second, the Enlightenment was secularized thought. The Enlightenment believed that where other cultures saw gods, where other cultures saw demons and spirits, we should see causal forces. We should understand the world as impersonal, as ruled by cause and effect, and therefore as discoverable. It's really important, I think, in the history of the West, the world can be understood by rational inquiry. Very, very different from most forms of traditional religion. Because what you do in religions, or in magic as well, is to propitiate the gods. The thing about religion is that to some degree you believe the world is ineffable, that the world is unknowable. Only God, or the shaman, or the magician, truly knows the world. To influence the world, you must propitiate the gods. The Enlightenment and modernity did away with all of that. There is no need for ritual. There's no need to light a candle. There is no need for burning one's goods for one's ancestors. The world is there to be understood in its totality. Fantastically radical idea, which has now become to be so commonplace that again we find it hard to extricate ourselves from it. Thirdly, the Enlightenment believed that we can control the world. This is really central to the spread of modernity. Modernity is all about controlling our lives through human intervention in a humanly organized world. Marx, Karl Marx in this sense again, was the prototypical thinker of Enlightenment, even though he came slightly later than the original Enlightenment thinkers, because Marx argued that previously human beings have made history without understanding it. Human beings have made history, but they have not understood what they were doing. Now, for the first time, we can consciously make history. The more we understand about our past, Marx says, the more we are able to break away from it, the more we're able to see history as a human project. The idea that the world can be humanly, rationally controlled is fundamental to modernity. It's sometimes called, after the mythical figure Prometheus, the Promethean idea. Promethean idea is that the world can be subject to human dominion. Now, I think we know in an age of ecological risk that there are limits to this. In conclusion, if you generalize each of these, you get the three major forces which are still ruling our lives at the end of the 20th century. Our lives are ruled, first of all, by the spread of Western industrial capitalism to become a global, increasingly global form of economic enterprise. Second, they're ruled by the spread of mass democracy, the idea of mass democracy being the key political idea, really, of the 20th century. And finally, they're ruled by the idea of the dominance of science and technology. Our society, in short, is a world which is capitalistic, which insists upon democratization, and which is dominated by science and technology. Has this civilization now met its limits? That's the kind of issue we discuss in subsequent lectures, so I hope to see some of you back here, and thanks very much for coming to this one. Thank you.